Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of The Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. As always, I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan, joined by my two compatriots. There is Danny King, writer for The Film Stage.
Thank you, Brian. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you, Danny. There's also Nick Newman, associate editor for The Film Stage.
Hello.
And also joining us today is our collaborator, Amanda Waltz.
Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hey.
How are you?
Oh, I'm so good.
Are you excited to be on the show?
Oh, boy. Yeah.
This is like the third or fourth time that we've like had you in hoc to be on the show, and this is like the first time it worked.
I can't remember what the first time was, actually. And then I ended up not seeing the film anyway, so it worked out for everybody.
Hooray. Well, you're here today to help us talk about 50 Shades of Grey.
Did you bring me on because you were like, we have to have a woman talk about this movie?
I was gonna say that it says something about us because we've had two women on the podcast. One is right now and the other was during Gone Girl. So I feel like we're engaging in some tokenism, but we don't really have a lot of guests on usually anyway, so I'm gonna say that all just a happy accident.
Hey, I'm all for it.
All right, great. Fantastic. You're going to give us the woman's perspective on this wonderful, handsomely made film. So this is a movie directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. It stars Dakota Johnson and Jamie Dornan. And it is based off of the New York Times best-selling novel. The trailers and posters for this movie call it the worldwide phenomenon, which I guess is possibly true. But that's what we'll be talking about today. Before we get into that, let me remind everyone that you can comment on these podcasts on the pages that they're published on The Film Stage. You can also find us on iTunes, where we always greatly appreciate comments and ratings. And you can also email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. I know we were supposed to do Jupiter Ascending last week. Timing just did not work out well for us at all. I'm going to go out on a limb and blame Nick for that. Does that sound about right, Nick?
The less said the last weekend, the better.
Oh gosh.
Well, yeah, I'm just going to leave it at that. It was not a weekend to see a movie. That's what I'll say that and then never say anything else about the matter.
Okay. Well, that was more than I was expecting. If you do want to know my thoughts on the film, my friend Dan Gvozden and I actually started a podcast called Movie Dare. So you can search that on iTunes. And our first pilot episode was actually on Jupiter Ascending because he dared me to watch it.
Seems like a good podcast for like February.
Yeah, I would say so. We also did our second podcast on 50 Shades of Grey. So I get to talk about this movie twice this weekend.
What's the premise of the show?
What's the premise? Well, Nick Newman, I'll tell you what the premise is. Dan and I dare each other and invite the audience to dare us to watch films that we may have avoided for one reason or another. So, obviously, 50 Shades of Grey, no explanation necessary, but maybe something like Dan, for some reason, has decided he never wants to watch Top Gun, so I'm going to try to dare him to watch that.
Top Gun?
Yeah, I don't know what the hell his problem is. It's a great movie. Or something like 27 Dresses. So, basically, making us watch either good or bad films that we've avoided for one reason or another.
I think your next episode should be on Mr. Brooks.
Oh, God.
Ooh.
But I've seen Mr. Brooks.
Well, the great thing about that is you get to see Dane Cook get destroyed.
Yeah, with a fucking shovel. It's great.
It's pretty great.
I don't know why I was thinking of Mr. Brooks. Please continue.
No one has thought of Mr. Brooks in like 4 years. Danny King has brought us back. No, our next episode's actually going to be on Showgirls, which I've never seen. So we got dared to watch that. But yeah, so check that out. Movie-dare.com or search Movie Dare on iTunes. I'm glad I was able to pull a plug for my podcast into this. But that's all. Let's get into our feature review of the erotic drama 50 Shades of Grey.
So this is just an interview for the newspaper. I just have a couple of questions. Mr. Gray will see you now.
What was he like?
He was polite, intense, smart, really intimidating. Do you have any interests outside of work?
What about you? I'd like to know more about you.
There's really not much to know about me. Look at me.
I am.
So, 50 Shades of Grey is based off of Twilight fan fiction that was written by someone on the internet. They changed it up a little bit to make it a new property, self-published it. It was picked up by a publisher. There's 3 books in the series. It has been widely consumed by all manner of people, has led to a spike in injuries as a result of sex toys, I just read in the Washington Post over the weekend. It is a cultural phenomenon, a force unlike any other, and it was a chance for Hollywood to take a known property and perhaps break through the image of prudishness that Hollywood has kind of hyped up around itself. We're a movie where billions of people are killed gets a PG-13, but anytime you see a woman orgasming, a movie gets an automatic R. So we're gonna talk about it. We're gonna get into this. We're gonna see if this is finally the movie that allows sex to break through to the mainstream of American cinema, and we're gonna see if it's possible to take sort of trashy source material and make something classy out of it. We'll see how that works. The storyline, such as there is one, involves a mousy young woman who falls under the thrall of a handsome billionaire, and the movie centers around his attempts to get her to sign a contract, basically giving away her free will and becoming his sex slave. Amanda, what is your history with this?
With BDSM?
I was going to say, what's your sexual history? just to break that down for us. No, so you read the Twilight novels that this began as fan fiction.
Oh, God, no.
I'm just going to say that.
I've seen the movies.
Oh, you saw the movies.
Some of them.
Some
yes.
of them. So you have, like, a very tenuous grasp, but probably still the biggest grasp that any of us do on the, like, lifeline of this. So going into the movie, what were you expecting, and what did you get?
Well, it actually exceeded my expectations.
Okay.
Not that that's saying a whole lot. But it is really, really difficult to separate this from Twilight because it is just the tone of it, the male sex figure, the female sex figure. It's all very similar. The one thing I will say about this that I was very surprised about, I haven't read the books. I only know this from all the hype surrounding it, especially with a lot of people boycotting the movie and saying that it glorifies abuse on women. But I found that Anastasia Steele, who is the lead character, and it does take place from her point of view for the most part, was much more assertive than I expected. I found that she was actually pretty funny at times. She had a personality unlike Twilight where there was nothing, just an empty vessel, which I kind of appreciated. And I did feel like one of the things that they did correctly was that they brought on a woman director. And I think doing so, she was able to appreciate the way that women would actually react to someone like Christian Grey because he is a incredible creep. And there's actually like the first half hour of the movie is a horror movie. Basically it is like Sleeping with the Enemy grade.
Oh yeah.
Campy horror. Yeah. And he does that wide eyed, but there's so many scenes where she even reacts to him. She isn't all in to begin with when she first meets him. Obviously she's taken with, oh, he's rich and he's young and he's kind, I guess, handsome. I don't know. Jamie Dornan isn't really my thing.
Doesn't do it for you.
Oh God, no.
That vacant, American Psycho-esque stare doesn't really get your motor running?
Well, and he's actually, as my friend who I saw this movie with reminded me, he actually plays a serial killer
in the fall. Yeah.
And I was like, why would you cast him knowing that? Because he is so creepy. And there's the scene where she's in a hardware store after she meets him. And she turns the corner and he's there. And she, of course, is startled because he's this billionaire rich man. What's he doing in my little mom and pop hardware store? Which I will say, I love that the movie really supports, you know, independently owned businesses.
It would have been so easy to get like a product tie-in with Home Depot or Lowe's.
I know.
But they didn't.
No, they didn't. And I respect that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good for you. But but she obviously doesn't want him there. And she's like, hey, okay, here's your cable ties. Please leave. And it's like if a billionaire, handsome young billionaire was hitting on me, my very first reaction would be, you're going to kill me and put my body in a cooler and dump it in the river, because there's no reason why you would be even looking at me.
Okay, and well, self-esteem issues aside, that's
no, it's
pretty
just
dark.
That's how every woman, like, and he's just so off-putting, and that is how women, if somebody walked up to us who was like that and became infatuated with us and we're just some mousy little, you know, nobody who works at a hardware store, you have to be like, this dude's a serial killer. No question. And I think that I kind of like that Taylor Johnson was very much aware of that. And I think that she injected that very well. But then, I don't know. I felt like it was, what I want to say, it was just so ridiculous. And like I was saying before, I'm still, even after watching the movie, I'm still very confused as to why people are so taken with it. Because, I mean, you know, I grew up with, one of the things was when I went into this movie, I read a tweet from, I think it was Samuel Adams, the film critic Samuel Adams, and he said that the movie was kind of an example of how de-eroticized our culture has become. And, you know, I grew up with like erotic thrillers. I grew up with stuff like Fatal Attraction and Basic Instinct and stuff. And those movies are way, way, way more like sexual and intense and raw. And this movie was just kind of lame. I just thought it was very lame and very kind of like not that. I don't know. I didn't feel like there was anything about it that would really be, I don't know. I just didn't get it. I'm still very confused as to why this is so different from like any other romance. And I mean, obviously you have to read it as a separate text from the book, but I'm really confused as to how this book, if this is what it is so like,
yeah. Why is this the one? That
yeah. Why is this? Out of all the romance novels, out of all the erotica, out of all everything that's out there, why is this the thing that everybody got into? Because it's pretty tame. I'll admit, it's very tame.
Yeah, it's insanely tame. I was expecting something from this movie. I don't know what I was expecting. I was expecting some sort of adventurous, really like mind-blowing, interesting sexual experience in the film, and it was all like the type of stuff that you think of in high school. Like there's nothing much beyond that. But
were you thinking about nipple clamps in high school?
What does that mean? I don't understand.
What do you mean? Like I guess there's a subtle form of escalation that occurs. And was I thinking about nipple clamps in high school? No, but I will point out that there are no actual nipple clamps in this movie.
No, I mean, then that's the thing. I was going in and there's the whole, and it's actually presented very comically. I mean, there's the scene where they're in the boardroom and she's having the meeting and she's stating about, which by the way, I don't even know why the contract is there. I don't even, that is the
contract is
the most useless plot device because it never comes into play. But she, you know, and she's sitting there talking about like, all right, butt plugs, you know, strike, or she asks what a butt plug is.
Right.
She's saying, oh, anal fisting, strike that. you know, vaginal fisting, strike that. And it's just like, tee hee hee hee. It's so like, I was just sitting there like, there are raunchy like comedies that are much more explicit than this movie is.
But I mean, that scene in the boardroom, I think, was meant to be funny.
Oh, for sure.
And I think that that's actually a scene where the actors and the director are kind of like winking.
Yeah.
At the audience being like, really, this is like the most extreme stuff you could think of? Like, this is like, we're going to skim it down to this level of prudity. Prudity? Oh, yeah. Prudity? I don't know.
Prudishness.
But yeah, Dick, to I guess address your point, it's not like there's not a lot in this that a person couldn't come up with just sitting around not knowing, like, you know, oh, well, we've been having sex for a while. Maybe we should spice it up a bit. What should we do? Oh, I don't know. Maybe I could tie you up. Maybe I could spank you. Like, that's it. Like, it doesn't go beyond that. There's not a lot of inventiveness to it, or even a lot of like abuse in either end of the term, you know, being either bad or, you know, the kind that people seek out. But Nick Newman, I am excited to hear what you thought of this film. So why don't you fill us in on your thoughts?
Well, our esteemed guest says, you know, she can't figure out why it, you know, why this is sort of the big thing it is. And I would echo that sentiment. And yet at the same time, I guess for me, the only thing that's really interesting about this film, a few specific, somewhat small components aside, what's really only interesting about it is its position as sort of a cultural object and what it may or may not say about, you know, I'll put this in scare quotes, the way we live now or something. Okay. And, you know, I mean, this was, you know, theater was filled up with a bunch of, you know, middle-aged women who, I guess, were there because they read the books. I mean, that seems to have been the target audience for it, right?
Yeah,
not the target audience, at least the predominantly the audience who kind of consumed these texts. And, you know, I mean, it's the film leaves very little impression. I think it's, you know, from sort of a sociological perspective, it's nice to see a female-directed, female-written, female-led film do this well. In particular, something that, I mean, those could almost sort of be like sort of like buzzwords and buzz categories, associations. What I think actually matters is that it's interesting to see, if not sex-heavy, a sex-centered film that makes no attempt to appeal to a male audience, or at least a straight male audience. I think there is something to be said for that, you know. That's kind of, yeah, I mean, that's cool.
Right.
Does that make for an enjoyable experience? I mean, I don't know. It was like, it was just something in the middle of the weekend for me, and then I kind of left and went on with the rest of my day. I didn't really mind sitting there. I don't know how much I would mind seeing a follow-up, because I think that the two of them have a worthwhile chemistry. They don't feel totally like a typical. they don't feel like a totally typical on-screen couple, I guess is what I would say. They feel like if there's a bit of a stiffness there, if there's a bit of a unfamiliarity. I mean, I think that kind of works. I think there is there's a quality to it that you don't really get very often. And that was kind of surprising. I mean, if you listen to the show, you know I can be a bit verbose. This is an instance where I'm kind of thinking, well, if I didn't totally react to it, I can understand. I mean, there are things about this that I just think don't work, plain. For one thing, just pretty much any exchange of dialogue is a bit cringe-inducing. But
Laters, baby.
But if the thing is, I can also acknowledge that this is not totally for me. Which is fine. Sometimes I like seeing something that's not totally for me, because I feel like that's an interesting test of my own tastes and interests and what exactly I gravitate toward in this medium. Not that this is going to really make me reconsider my relationship with the medium, but it's more than I was expecting. I'll say that. Overall, it's fine. It's fine. I don't know what else to say.
You just don't want angry comments from 40-year-old women.
Oh, I can
all the 40-year-old women who listen to
this podcast.
Obviously
read our site.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wait, I want to go to the grumbling noise that Amanda made.
Oh, the chemistry part?
Yeah. Did you not find that there were moments between them that worked?
Yeah. Okay.
You thought they had no chemistry whatsoever?
She was so all in. And honestly, I think this movie made her look so... I do think that she looks... She kind of comes out as the more powerful character, not just in... Or even in the even as the more powerful performance. I think Dakota right. Johnson was actually pretty great. And I think that she is portrayed way better. I think that her character is portrayed way better. And I think he is just like a BDSM robot.
Yeah.
Who yeah. is just kind of... And there, I actually... like even and then there, when the moments when he is trying to be a little bit more like playful or intimate, like I think there's a note that I was actually looking through my notes earlier and I laughed because I wrote down erotic toast because this scene where
I remember the scene.
Yeah, oh God, how can we forget the erotic toast scene?
He crawls on the bed and takes a bite of the toast. Oh, that's so horrible.
But the weird thing is, like, he's this guy who apparently is driven by the desire to have this kind of sex. Like, it seems as though he is one, like, draft of this script away from just being a fully-fledged sex addict. And, like, right. He doesn't exude any, like, kind of sexuality.
I agree. Yeah, that's actually my friend actually called him a Ken doll.
Yeah.
At one point.
Pretty much.
Which I think too, it's like I think the idea of it is that, oh, he's holding back because he's trying to get her. And I think the whole thing with the contract, like in the beginning, the contract was, oh, he doesn't want her going out because he has this empire and he doesn't want her going out and telling everybody that, you know, he likes to put butt plugs in women. And what is his business?
Oh,
what does he do?
They said it was like telecommunications and African agrarian work.
What?
Look, I don't know.
But so that's what in the beginning I was like, oh, that's why he wants her to sign the contract. And then he's like, oh, fuck the contract.
But he has her sign like a non-disclosure agreement. Which
okay.
She does.
Oh, she does sign the non... Okay, right. I must have missed that when
but
I was...
But then there's like this contract of like, hey, this is all the shit I get to do to you. Which is not, okay. That cannot be a legally binding contract. Like, there's no legal precedent for that, right?
I don't know.
Like,
I'm not worldly enough.
I happen to have friends in the community, the BDSM community. And I know that, like, they like, make verbal agreements because it's still all about, like, love and trust. But it's like a relationship. Like, when you post, or prenups aside... When you get in a relationship, you don't write down things. Like, that's a sitcom plot. Like, this,
yeah.
So the whole movie loses, like, an element of basic human reality and just has this inserted thing.
And I think that's where the fantasy aspect of it is supposed to come in, which I don't know, which is so strange to me because it's like, my fantasies don't involve a business arrangement.
I was about to say... Business major fantasists, you know, they're always like, I love romance and I love sex, but if only we could get contract law in there somehow.
It's just
this
like,
is
oh,
the movie for you.
Look at Appendix 5,
yeah.
Section 3. Yeah. And then one thing that I found interesting, though, was I think she actually is kind of the voice of the audience in a lot of the way.
Oh, my God.
In a
yes.
lot of the ways, because she keeps egging him on and she's like, oh, you keep saying that you have these crazy extreme tastes. Just show me. She keeps asking him. And
yeah,
finally,
like, stop being a coy little bitch and just show me what you want or show me what you're going to do.
And I think that's one of the reasons why I'm having a tough time. I mean, and I understand the way people interpret the film as glorifying abuse towards women. That's fine. You can totally read it that way. I think that's why I don't really see it that way, because she's the one who's saying, like, oh, my God, just show me. You keep
right.
saying, oh, yeah, I have such extreme taste.
My tastes are very singular. Why are we making him Batman?
That actually sounds like Louis C.K.'s impersonation of Shitty Dudes. I don't know. If you're familiar with his stand-up routine, it sounds exactly like that.
But, I mean, that thought works. That was just a universal impression of Shitty Dudes.
Sure, sure.
This
but
is
yeah,
funny.
That's, I think that's why I'm just like, yeah, she kind of was like, hey, dude, show me. And then he shows her and she's like, no, thanks, I'm good.
Yeah, but, and then she leaves.
Yeah, it's like, cool, good for you, girl.
But like the thing that drives her away to me does not appear to be any more extreme than anything they've already done.
I think it's, yeah, I guess. But I, you know, I think before it was like the ostrich feather and the...
It was a peacock.
Or, oh, peacock. Oh, you're right.
Peacocks are the colorful ones. Ostriches are the not colorful ones.
Okay, you're right. It was
are you colorblind? I'm sorry. I shouldn't have made that assumption.
Oh, no, no. No one is going to take me seriously.
Oh, God.
No one's... I've been discredited. I might as well just get out of the game.
Pretty much. Scrap the whole podcast. God damn it.
We're going to get so many angry comments, you guys.
We're being pretty ableist right now, actually.
Yeah.
Oh, well. But, Danny King, we've heard a little bit from you, but now it's your turn to shine. What did you think of 50 Shades of Grey?
I kind of enjoyed this movie. I think one reason might be because I just had no expectations, not even in the sense that I expected it to be bad, but I just really had no idea what the source material was like or what the plot was. And one of the things that sort of intrigues me about the Twilight comparison is that I feel like this movie, for a blockbuster film that's being invested with so many resources, is almost like amazingly plotless. And so when you look at a Twilight series and it's like, okay, we're going to tell a love story between this girl and this guy, what genre element are we going to add to it? And so for that, it's vampires. For this, based on the marketing, it's like, I guess it's BDSM. That's the thing that distinguishes it. But if you go into the movie without really expecting kind of crazy stuff, and if you're just sort of aware with what the MPAA is going to allow to be rated R, you're not going to be really... I mean, I wasn't going to this movie to be like, oh shit, I can't wait to see like what shocking things I'm going to see in this AMC theater from this wide release. And so I didn't have any heightened expectations like that going in. And the other thing that Amanda hinted at is I think that the director is so attuned to having this film be made from the perspective of the girl, and Dakota Johnson is so good that I feel like the whole movie is really sincere emotionally from her perspective. So, you know, a lot of people are kind of like giggling throughout this movie, but I sort of approached it. I mean, aside from the scenes that are obviously meant to be funny, I sort of approached a lot of it as just kind of genuine melodrama about this girl, being greeted with this sort of insane love interest. And I agree with Amanda that Johnson is like really good in the movie. I mean, that scene in the hardware store, he's creepy, but I think her comic timing is like really good. And then her drunk dial is when I really like fell in love with her. And I'm like,
oh my God, I would love to see her in a straight comedic role.
She was in the show Ben and Kate on Fox. That was actually kind of funny.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah.
Sorry. Cool. I got way too excited.
You're like, finally, someone's talking about Ben and Kate.
I don't know. I don't know what Ben and Kate is. But she's really funny. And the other thing that I talked about is like I was just sort of amazed to be seeing a blockbuster that is so flimsily plotted. Like if you brought this screenplay into a class, the first question would be like, okay, what's the conflict? After the first scene at his office, it would be like, okay, well, what's his business? Like so many things just go unanswered. That I was sort of found it amusing. And it's like, yeah, I guess the contract is the plot, but there are like multiple scenes where, the guy is sort of frustrated. He's like, fuck the contract. It's basically like this movie doesn't have a plot. So I sort of like, as far as seeing cultural phenomenon movies, it's like, I'll take like one kind of okay melodrama a year. Like I'm fine with that. And the other thing is the cinematographer of this movie is pretty good. His name's like Seamus McGarvey.
He did The Gray, didn't he?
No.
He did. Fuck. What did he do? I can't remember now.
He did We Need to Talk About Kevin. But then he's sort of like become a blockbuster guy. So he did like Godzilla. Anna Karenina.
That's what I was thinking of. Yeah.
But I mean, I think most of this movie is sort of like doesn't look that distinctive. Like it just kind of seems like a ripoff of some of the 80s, like corporate kind of. A
lot of steel gray stuff.
Yeah. Like,
because she's the gray motif, steel. And he's Christian Gray.
Oh, that's a good analysis.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm going to do a whole video thing on this entire movie.
But there's a couple scenes. One of them is the contract scene where it's like, I don't even know where the lighting is coming from in that scene, but it looks like purple or something.
It's like from behind a frosted glass panel.
Yeah. I was just like, this is cool. Like, and then there's one scene near the end where it's kind of like dramatic and she's like laying on the bed and it's like the raindrops on the window are kind of falling across her face. And that was kind of really nice, I think. And one of the funny things about that scene is I won't like spoil the content, but like I was watching that scene and I'm like, I feel like I've been sitting in this movie for like an hour and 50 minutes, which means it should be close to ending. But like from a screenplay perspective, it would make no sense for this movie to end in 5 minutes. And of course it did. So like there's something like obviously incomplete about the ending. It just doesn't feel like a full story. It'd be like if you watched Nymphomaniac Part 1 and then had to like wait a year to finish it.
But I mean, like even there, like you could almost forgive an ending like that if this were like a character driven like drama of manners.
This film?
Yeah, but it's not.
Yeah, no, it's just sort of like a cliffhanger. But yeah, I sort of found the film kind of curious and thought the performance was really good. So I agree that the guy is not that good. And his first scene is especially
oh God.
Is not good. But I actually think one of the things that I liked about the movie is like Amanda talked about how in the first half hour he's like a serial killer. But I feel like by the end he's actually there's really not much that's intimidating about him at all. So
no.
I think in a way like the fact that the movie isn't as extreme as maybe like it was marketed as actually works in its favor because he seems more like, I mean, down to earth is not the right term. He's like a billionaire, but like,
well, because he's his family, and you know, with any BDSM fantasy, you meet your Dom's mother,
yeah,
and his sister and his dad, which oh god,
yeah, like the first scene when she meets his mom was sort of telling because like if this guy's actually acting out this fantasy of being this like untouchable billionaire sex god, he's probably going to be like waiting in my bedroom while I tell my mom to like leave and not like, I don't know, come out and meet her and like hang out. Like
yeah.
he seemed sort of like there were a lot of moments where it's like, this guy's not.
Well, he's that. Constantly like, I'm not good at, or I don't do relationships. I'm not good at relationships.
And he seems like he does.
He's like, freaking great at it.
Yeah, like it seems like they're just sort of.
He
like
really
love.
Wants one, you guys.
And I think that's part of it. I think like that's part of like the fantasy is like, oh, he like this is a guy we're going to be able to save.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
Like, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But like there's so little to that. And so like the movie gets so close to being interesting and good so many times.
Yeah.
That like by the end I was just really frustrated, really really frustrated by this film.
You just want them to get together so bad, Brian.
Right? I just want them to work it out.
Those two crazy kids.
Like he's telling her about like his bad abused like childhood before his mom died and he got adopted.
That is a whole nother issue.
And I was just like, come on, wake up so you can hear this heartfelt story and understand where he's coming from.
You thought that was heartfelt?
I was 100% joking right there. Please don't think that I meant that.
I'm so sorry.
No, I mean, Jesus, that whole... Well, first of all, he has all these scars on his chest, and I thought that they were bullet wounds. And
really?
Yeah. So I was, like, really hoping that he is, like, oh, there was this one time where I was almost assassinated, or something. But then he's like, oh no, they're burn marks. And I'm like, oh, that's not cool.
Well, he even says at one point that when he gives the commencement speech that he remembers being profoundly hungry. And so it keeps giving these hints at his past and in the very beginning when they're doing all the exposition during the interview. And she's like, oh, you were adopted when you were four. And he tries to get away from that. And yeah, that whole thing about his crack addict prostitute mother, birth mother. My God.
Just say it out loud. It's awful. What?
It's awful. It's really just, and it is, that's the one thing that is the thing that I really took issue with, because I think it's one of the, it's a very like Jacqueline Suzanne type. I'm sorry, I'm gonna bring my old lady like literature into this, but it is, it's like there are Jacqueline Suzanne like novels from the 60s that do that kind of stuff where, you know, it is just this man is the victim and she has to save him. And of course, you know, why would anybody like BDSM unless they were completely fucked up? And
50 Shades of Fucked Up, as it were.
50 Shades of Fucked Up. Oh, God. But it's, yeah, and it's that thing where I think that's the one thing that people complain about this movie where I actually do sympathize with them. I'm like, yeah, I kind of agree. This movie does give this sort of like ridiculous, like, I don't know, just, I wouldn't say harmful necessarily, because it is a fantasy. It is something that just some woman who probably does not do this in real life cooked up. I would guess. I've seen E.L. James. She might be a dom. I don't know. But it's just like, I don't. Yeah. And it's just awful. It's just a very lazy way of like complicating a character who's really not at all, who doesn't have a personality beyond that.
Right. And like what you said, this movie feels like it was written by someone who only did a Google image search for like dom and submissive.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. Like that was the whole of the research process. And it really is frustrating, because it's like, you know, Danny was talking about the cinematographer on this. He has done Atonement. He has done The War Zone. He's done The Avengers.
That's so crazy.
Right. He's done some good stuff. And then we have the director who did Nowhere Boy, which I heard things about. But I mean, like, you know, this movie is competently directed. Dakota Johnson is fantastic in it. Jamie Dornan, I mean, I would love to know what directions he got as a character. Be shirtless in this scene, I believe, was probably one of the most frequent ones. But there's things that are happening that could be good. And if he were to start off as like a serial killer-y seeming guy, and then you learn that that's like his way of keeping people on the outside because of whatever intimacy issues or something he has, like, that'd be fine. I'd be cool with that. But it's just, there are so many like missed opportunities and bungled moments. And it's so, I went into this movie expecting, I'm not going to like this movie, but I'm going to hate it possibly. And it's going to tell me something about the state of cinema and Hollywood's cynicism about female audiences and gender norms and, you know, sexuality in cinema. But instead what I got was something that was like maybe one or two passes on the screenplay away from actually being a decent-ish film. The one that treats sex with a level of sterility that is frankly shocking. And so it frustrated me more than anything else. Like, there are scenes that I believe I would earnestly go back and watch again. And yet I could never see the whole thing again, because the whole does not hang together well at all.
When I think, just talking about the production, and that it is a plotless film, I feel like they filled a lot of time with just aerial shots, just long aerial shots of people driving. And this is, it started looking like a car commercial. Yeah. There's a lot of cars in this movie just driving to, I don't know, where do they go at one point? Savannah. and Portland and Seattle, and then there's
these characters live 90 miles away from each other.
It's you know, it's just,
and then you have the helicopter scene, and then you have the airplane scene.
Oh, that glider scene.
Yeah.
There's like a lot of filler with the supporting characters too. It's sort of a clear like first installment depiction of supporting characters where you just sort of like introduce who they are without giving them anything interesting to do.
She's got this friend named Jose who like opens the car door for her and then does pictures and then like tries to kiss her and then just disappears. But then you get like a check-in on him like an hour and a half into the film later, where her like friend is dating the guy's brother, and it's like, oh, plus he's like really good friends with Jose now. So anyone who is worried about Jose gets to know that he's doing fine. It's the
also,
weirdest thing.
Rita Ora plays his sister, I'm guessing adoptive sister. Well, he's adopted, so she has to be.
Right.
But, and she has maybe one or two lines. I don't think she has any lines.
Screenplay. Like, it's not great.
Then she's a pretty, I would say she's a fairly big name.
Marcia Gay Harden is his mom.
Dude, she is delightful.
for her 2 minutes of screen time.
Could not have welcomed her more.
Mother.
When
of God.
She sashays in that trench coat, oh, beautiful.
Okay. I think I want to wrap up this discussion.
Okay.
By just talking about the plot keywords that are on the IMDb page for this. So, you know, IMDb has some of the weirdest, most specific plot keywords, and they display 5 or 6 of them. And then say, see all of them. On the main page for 50 Shades of Grey, it begins, perversion, sex scene, BDSM, helicopter, bondage. I think that is a perfect summation of how this movie is.
Oh, wow.
Just helicopter in there. And it makes sense. It makes sense with everything we're saying. Because, yeah, there's a lot of lavish time spent on his wealth. And that pretty much takes care of his entire character, as far as the movie seems concerned. It's upsetting. I am glad to see that, you know, I guess Hollywood's willing to take a risk on something like this. And maybe this sex in film and, like, you know, having another female-led film, you know, targeted at a female audience, this time with a female director, maybe this is, like, a way that we can finally start to break down the ever-present gender disparity in Hollywood. But I just don't know. And I wish the movie had been better, because it comes really close to being decently okay at points. Any final thoughts on this? Nick, you've been pretty silent recently.
Yeah. nice color palette, which has never really been said.
It is a good color palette. Do we see this getting a cinematography nom?
No.
Okay.
Mostly because it's released, you know, a year away from the Oscars.
You don't think there's going to be like a qualifying run?
No.
I will actually say, though, in terms of sound design, my friend made a point that there's a lot of there's a lot of emphasis on hands and close-ups of hands, and it's very tactile. And I, watching it, I was just thinking, I really would have liked to see them use something maybe like. It made me think of Strange Color of Your Body's Tears and how sound and text was used to sort of make it a little bit more, I don't know. I was just thinking like, oh, I kind of want this to be a little more like hyper-sensual.
Right, but it's not.
It should have been directed by Claire Denis.
Yeah.
Everything is in the wide or the medium. Like, there's
Well, I was just thinking, you know, like he has this crazy playroom with all of these, you know, it's like he has these wooden rods and he has these feathers and he has these. And I was just thinking like, ooh, there's just so many opportunities for like textures and there's all these. And I just think I don't know. That was just one of the things I was thinking about when I was watching it.
Because there's like a show stopping sex montage in the middle of this. That's all just scored to a new version of Crazy in Love by Beyonce. Mm-hmm. And so there's like very little, there's like no sound of them like even vocalizing. There's nothing.
I think that's a missed opportunity.
It is. And like on the other podcast I did about this, I said it's like a perfume ad in both its beauty and its complete lack of humanity. Like, they did have an opportunity to draw you in that way, and they purposefully avoided it, even though that's what people are ostensibly coming to this to get.
Yeah.
I don't know why that would be.
Yeah, I read one review. I can't remember who wrote it right now, but it was like, I would love to watch all the sex scenes, just taking out the score and the songs and leaving in the noises just from the actors and like the diegetic sound, basically.
Yeah.
And you could think about how much more interesting it would be to watch those scenes in a crowded theater, because if you're watching a sex scene about to begin and then Beyonce starts singing, you can basically just sit back in your chair and be like, oh, okay, this will be like a 3-minute boring sex scene.
Yeah.
But if like that song like never,
action scene.
Yeah. If that song never comes on and you have to like listen to like some interesting things, it would make it like more surprising.
I mean, it's the difference between like a Michael Bay action scene that's scored to like electric guitars and a Michael Mann action scene that's just punctuated by the sound of gunshots.
Oh yeah, man's a master.
Like one of those draws you in, and the other is cool to look at, but doesn't really give you anything.
Although to be fair, didn't Michael Mann also score one of his action scenes to what was that song in Manhunter? I'm trying to remember.
This is
Strong as I Am.
Strong as I Am.
Well, he does use music well. Like
the theatrical cut of Miami Vice has a huge error where it uses a non-point cover of "In the Air Tonight" over the climactic action sequence. It's a terrible, terrible song.
Right.
Oh no, sorry. I should say the director's cut does. The theatrical cut, the superior version, is music free.
It is music free.
So sometimes he does, but most of the time it is.
Well, I'm thinking of like Public Enemies, and I think Black Hat, that big action scene that happens. Like most of those don't have any score. Or at least the score doesn't stick out in my mind. Like, you have the sound of bullets, the sound of gunfire. And I think that this movie could have benefited from more of that. If anything, this movie suffers from not being...
It's not sensual.
No, it's not.
At all. There's a total lack of sense. just in general.
Yeah, no, it's weird. It's weird in that way. Because I went into this movie expecting, like, not pornography, but like... attempts at sensuality done very poorly, and this one it like removed sensuality in order to make the scenes work well but without any of the heat behind it.
Yeah, it's something like, I don't know, like what, Red Shoe Diaries, or it's sort of like something that you would find at Cinemax, and
yeah,
that's sort of like, ooh, it's European, so it's okay. It's artful, but no, it's not.
No. So, massive missed opportunity. But I'm still pretty glad I went and saw this, because, I don't know, there was something about it. There was some level of artistry behind it that was more than I was expecting, and that gave me hope as being a stepping stone towards maybe something better in the future. Maybe not in this franchise, but at least out there in the world. So, yeah, that's that. Let's get into Blu-rays that are coming out really quickly. Birdman will be hitting Blu-ray on the 17th, as will The Interview, Dumb and Dumber 2, The Theory of Everything, and Saint Vincent, as well as Life Itself and The Homesman. So apparently a really big week for new DVD releases. Anyone have any of these that they want to say people should check out? Wow, okay.
All right.
I thought we all kind of liked Birdman a little bit.
Birdman's fun. Yeah. It's fun, but like I saw it once, I never need to see it again.
Yeah. Right, but if someone was waiting, let's assume that people at home are like, oh, I was waiting for that for DVD. Should I see that?
Yeah, sure. It's
sure. Yeah, it's sort of like a sure.
Unic on Blu-ray. That's where it's
Unic,
at, I think.
Yeah. Unic is pretty good. Has anyone seen St. Vincent?
No.
I think everybody kind of forgot
that was happening.
That movie happened. Yeah,
I'd like to see... I'd like to see that. I know Danny was a fan.
Yeah, The Homesman's really good. And there's also Dying of the Light on Blu-ray.
Oh, goodness.
Oh, no.
Support Paul Schrader Cinema. Thank you.
That doesn't support him by buying it.
Yeah, no, basically.
Oh, support him by not buying it.
Yeah. Also, The Tale of the Princess Kaguya, the Ghibli film was supposed to be really great. I wanted to see that. That was one of the few films I did not see before making my top 10 in 2014 that I thought was kind of an omission. So there's that, you know.
Coming to theaters, Oh, I'm sorry, Amanda. Did you have something?
Oh no, I was just gonna say I totally agree with Kaguya. It's gorgeous.
All right.
Okay. And yeah, it's definitely worth, I would say, owning. So.
All right. Well, that's gonna be our main selection then. Yeah, Birdman. I don't ever need to see again. Coming to theaters, talking about something I never see to see again. The Hot Tub Time Machine 2. Moving on. We also have something called The Duff. As well.
Oh,
as,
yeah.
What's that?
Is this a good? Is this something to be excited about?
I got, well, because I'm a member of GoFobo.
Oh, okay.
And they sent me. They were like, "You can go see The Duff tonight," and I was like, "I have no clue what that is." And now I'm just starting to see.
It's opening in 2,500 theaters. Apparently, I've never heard of this.
It's a Egg from Arrested Development.
Her?
Yeah, it's her and I want to say Emma Roberts. And yeah, that's it. That's all I know.
According to this, a high school senior instigates a social pecking order revolution after finding out that she has been labeled the Duff, designated ugly fat friend to her prettier, more popular friends. Okay. It's that famous Nick Newman sign that everyone looks for. Also, McFarland, USA.
A Kevin Costner sports drama, yes.
The newest Kevin Costner film that people forget happened.
He's got two out, man. He's...
I want to see Black or White for, like, humorous. Like, it looks really bad.
Yeah, it does not look good. This comes hot on the heels of Draft Day and 3 Days to Kill as well. So this guy is... Whew. Anyway.
At least he's working.
Yeah, you know, he's making his money. He's
you gotta pay the bills.
Something called Wild Tales... Gloria, and that's it. So, stick to those DVDs and Blu-rays. We're going to be talking about something coming out in limited release or expanding possibly The Voices or What We Do in Shadows this coming weekend. So, keep an eye out. I'm sure we'll announce that on Twitter when we figure out.
Or Jupiter Ascending.
Yeah, we could always talk about Jupiter Ascending. Anyway, so, really quick, let's give our random selections of stuff that we watched on our own. And then we can get the hell out of here. So, Amanda, why don't you kick us off? Tell us what you saw. Tell us what was good about it.
Oh, recently? Let me think.
Yeah, recently.
You might have to give me... Well, I'll move on to somebody else.
Right,
I have to think about it for a second.
Sure. I would have talked about this last week, but since it won't come out on Blu-ray until tomorrow, or I guess by the time this episode is posted, and I'm sort of obligated to talk about it since it was sent to me, I will discuss a motion picture called Les Pentes du Nord, which is a 1981 feature by Jacques Rivette, the great French filmmaker who, despite being considered one of the greatest artists who emerged from the whole New Wave scene, is fairly underrepresented in the United States as far as access to his films is concerned. And now Kino Lorber are releasing a Blu-ray of this feature of his, usually considered one of his best. And
so what's good about it?
Well, I watched it, and I was really quite taken with it. It's basically this film that, not basically, it is a film that takes place entirely outdoors in Paris and follows these two women who are kind of playing this very strange, purposefully unexplained game involving these documents that one of their former lovers is possessing, involving sort of this criminal conspiracy. And they're jumping around the city of Paris from one arrondissement to the next, looking for these pages and trying to sort of clear someone's name. That's about as much as I can sum it up. It's really more a film of mood and tone and kind of just going through the city of Paris with these two women, played by Boule Ogier and Pascal Ogier, a mother-daughter pairing, respectively. Mm-hmm. And even though the characters themselves are not mother and daughter, that is still just how it was in life, mother and daughter.
Right.
Understood.
But anyway,
so wrapping up, what do you get from this?
I mean, if you've never seen a Rivette film, and I'm still a little new to him myself, you'll find that there's just kind of this very fun experience sitting down and watching these two women walk around Paris and talk to each other and engage in this strange conspiracy that doesn't totally make sense, but doesn't really need to. It's kind of like what I wanted to get from Inherent Vice, but didn't exactly in terms of that kind of direction. the movie is just a great deal of fun, but there's quite a bit to dig into as well. There's a very melancholic center to it that I find myself thinking about a week on. I'm going to have a piece on it going on the site, again, probably by the time this episode is posted. It's a really nice film. Hopefully Netflix will have it, but if not, I don't know, come to my house and I'll let you borrow it.
Okay. Danny King, what about yourself? Be shorter than Nick.
My choice actually requires a little backstory.
God damn you. Why?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
What backstory could you possibly need? Tell us the title. Tell us it's good.
No, it's humorous backstory. Okay. You're going to laugh. Okay. So the other week, I got assigned to review a small film called White Rabbit. So I look it up on IMDb, and the synopsis is a bullied high school student envisions a rabbit that he killed when he was a kid. And so I like laugh. I'm like, that's a weird premise. So I look up the director. His name's Tim McCann. I'm going through his other films. I click on one called Nowhere Man from 2005, and I'm going to read the IMDb synopsis word for word because it's hysterical. So it goes, a desperate man ventures into a dangerous and sordid underworld of crime and pornography in search of his severed genitalia, which is held for ransom by his disgruntled former girlfriend.
Okay.
So I'm like, if I'm going to review White Rabbit, I have to watch Nowhere Man first.
Obviously.
So I watch Nowhere Man. It's insane. I do a little research on this director. I find out that a lot of really good critics, two of them would be Jonathan Rosenbaum and Scott Foundas, think this guy is like a really underappreciated independent filmmaker. But anyway, this is more of like a shout out to Tim McCann than an individual recommendation, because White Rabbit is like very problematic. But like, so if you have,
like, yeah, what's up, man?
I mean, I'm just like so fascinated by this. But if you have a instant video account on Amazon, you can watch Nowhere Man. It's 70 minutes.
The cover art is amazing.
It's amazing. No, I mean, it's shocking. And I think Foundas's quote was like, if Blake Edwards wrote a script and Abel Ferrara directed it, it would be Nowhere Man. I mean, it's just insane. Like, Tim McCann, support Tim McCann.
Yeah, he's actually one of the heads of the film program at my school. So
yeah, so he...
It's interesting to think he's making these films and then teaching friends of mine.
There's something about this guy that we have to appreciate.
Amanda, have you come across something that you want to share?
Kind of. Well, I just actually recently subscribed to Hulu Plus, so not necessarily newer movies that I want to promote, but sort of some stuff that you can access on Hulu Plus. And one of them is this movie called The Battery. And it came out in 2012, and it's directed by Jeremy Gardner. And it's this very, I want to say, it's a super indie zombie movie about these two baseball players who are sort of
You really want to talk about pasta, don't you?
I do. Oh my God, my meatloaf. I have to go check on that. now that I'm thinking about it.
Please don't edit that out.
No.
I have to go check on my meatloaf. Yeah, but it's about these two baseball players who are sort of the only... they're sort of their only companions, and they're traversing the American landscape after this zombie apocalypse happens. But it's very naturalistic. It's beautifully shot, actually. It's super low tech. It doesn't, you know, it's very bare bones. And the one guy is amazing. I can't remember his name, but he's the bearded one, if you watch the movie, because there's only two characters, so you'll know who I'm talking about. He's amazing. And it's actually, I get sick of, you know, because the whole zombie thing has been so tired for so long. But I actually thought the way that this movie approached it was really interesting. And it's actually very enjoyable. And I like the relationship between the two guys, because you can tell that if in the normal world, they probably wouldn't be friends, but they have to kind of tolerate and deal with one another because they're basically the all that they have. The other thing was, because I can access all the Criterion stuff on Hulu Plus, I watched Equinox, which was this, it was supposed to be a student film. It's a 16 millimeter horror movie that was made in the late 60s. The guy who directed it, I'm trying to remember, but it's actually really amazing and it's super low budget. It's, there's a lot of very really well done, like Ray Harryhausen-esque stop motion monsters. And as I keep saying, like, it's basically a less inept Manos Hands of Fate, because it's this like, because it does look amazing. And there's these really great, like, in the crazy story that's going on, there's these beautiful shots of the California landscape. And if you've like read about it and wondered like, oh, maybe I should watch it, it's definitely worth a watch. It's kind of like an amazing sort of artifact of the like 60s indie movie scene. So,
all right.
But yeah, those are my two suggestions.
I'm going to make two suggestions just because they're both on HBO Go and they're both amazing and everyone should check them out. The first is Her, which I know we all know that we all love.
The Spike Jonze film?
Yes, the Spike Jonze.
I don't think we all love it.
Yeah, I was really kind of mixed on that.
Fuck, I just remember that.
I thought you were kind of mixed.
Loved Her. Jesus, Danny. It's like you don't even know me. Anyway, right. So I loved Her beyond all reasoning. I think it was my number two or something film of the year. Doesn't matter. It was great. It's on HBO Go, so check it out if you haven't already. Also on HBO Go is Edge of Tomorrow, which was very underseen and very enjoyable. That's the Tom Cruise Groundhog's Day meets Battle Los Angeles film. And it's amazing, and you should check it out.
You know what's interesting is that neither of those movies are amazing.
You don't think Groundhog Day is amazing?
No, Groundhog Day is, but Edge of Tomorrow is not.
What?
Neither is Her.
I'd say the first half hour was enjoyable. After that, the novelty of it kind of wore off for me.
There are very good aspects of that movie, but as a whole, I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay, I think you're nuts. That's fine. Never mind. You know what? Not engaging. Let's wrap it up. Amanda, why don't you tell us where you can be found on the internet in between this and whenever you come upon the show next?
I don't have anything for the film stage, but you can actually read my blog. I cover the Pittsburgh film culture scene. It's Steel Cinema at WordPress. So if you're not living in Pittsburgh, but you want to know what's going on in Pittsburgh film-wise, I guess you can read it. But I'm actually coming up. I am doing a review of queer culture and gaming. It's a documentary called Gaming in Color. I'm going to be doing that for a site called Queer Video Vault. It's a local nonprofit that sort of hosts LGBTQ events around Pittsburgh, and they're great. They're really wonderful. So I'm doing a review for them, so you could watch out for that. So that's about it.
Will you be tweeting that out, or?
Yeah, I'll be tweeting it out.
Us where you are on Twitter?
Oh, on Twitter, I am at. I'm
very
at Media Wolf.
Very subtle segue, Brian.
Just push you in the right direction.
Thank you.
No problem. What was your Twitter handle again?
Media Waltz.
Media Waltz. All right. Nick Newman, what about yourself?
TheFilmStage.com, Twitter.com/Nick_Newman.
Danny King.
TheFilmStage.com, Twitter.com/TheKingBulletin, and DearFilm.net.
God, what the fuck? Anyway, my personal site is DearFilm.net. That's weird. I was not expecting that. I can be found on Twitter at Twitter.com/BrianJRowan. And, of course, we talked about it earlier. I'll bring it up again. My newest podcast is Movie Dare. Find it on iTunes or go to movie-dare.com. And I think we all, Tanny, Nick, you're writing on this too, right? The 50 best films of the last 5 years?
That's
hitting the film stage soon enough.
Yeah, I picked some weird ones. So.
As did I.
Okay.
All right, well, that's it. Like I said, join us next week when we'll be talking about something that's in limited release. But other than that, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. Tune in next time.